Welcome to another audience interview brought to you by the Speed Art Museum and Kentucky Tourism Arts and Heritage Cabinet. I'm your host today, Doug Driesbach, and we're excited to catch up with one of the most inspirational individuals in Louisville and the music director of your Louisville Orchestra, Teddy Abrams. Since arriving in Louisville in 2013-14 season, right in there, Teddy has been a boost of energy not only for the Louisville Orchestra, but for the Louisville arts scene across the board. So without further ado, welcome, Teddy.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's always exciting to get advocates of the arts and people as inspiring as you are on the phone. You know, your bio describes you as a tireless advocate of the power of music. What does that mean?
Well, I hope that I can live up to whatever it says in the bio, but I think whoever wrote that was hopefully describing my belief that the music is an essential part of how I think a community or society can find commonality. And the power of music to cut through different backgrounds and to break down barriers that people have created for themselves cannot be underestimated. And I think a lot of times we tend to fall into the nice, comfortable little paths for our art forms throughout the life cycle of an artist or an arts institution, but my interest is in going way beyond the lane lines that we've kind of created for ourselves. Whether we have thought about it that way or not, I think we always tend to just do what's comfortable, or at least do what seems most natural. But my interest in music is in really using the language to expand and to build society, as opposed to creating kind of the narrow pathways that seem like they're just right in front of ourselves.
Well, you've got quite the musical background, and we could probably talk about it for hours. But at a relatively young age, you really got into playing music, and you were one of the youngest students accepted into the Curtis Institute of Music, as well as the Aspen Music Festival, and many other accomplishments. But what were some of your early musical influences growing up, and how have those contributed to your work today that you're doing and throughout your career?
Well, like any musician, you're basically made up of all the musical experiences that you have, with a weighted kind of component of the early memories and the early mentors, especially the classical music world, where mentorship is so critical from an early age. You are kind of an amalgam and a composite of those various experiences, and especially the people that extend themselves early on to offer guidance and counsel and training have a lasting impact on how you see the musical world, the artistic landscape, and so on. And through the lens of a classical musician, of course, you know, every musician has influences, and some of them you may never actually know. They may be purely artistic and musical, and they may not be personal, but from the lens of a classical musician, you have to have those personal relationships. It's not something you can avoid. The language and the techniques required really demand that you have people in your life that train you, and usually on a one-on-one basis. It's one of the last, I would say, not just art forms, but any kind of genre or vocation that requires that kind of one-on-one master and pupil relationship, which seems kind of archaic in a lot of ways these days, but in music it's preserved, and I was very fortunate to have a number of people early on that went so far above and beyond even the expectations of that kind of teacher-student relationship, and they really, I think, recognized what I was maybe either capable of or what I wanted to do with music, and I certainly had kind of a capacious understanding of what a life in music might mean for me. I wanted to conduct from a very early age, surprisingly early. I think most people decide they might want to conduct much later in life. That's not something you'd really expect from a kid. And I was 9 years old when I decided this is what I wanted to do. And as I said, that you could think that that's what you want to do all you want, but you have to have people in your life that guide you along that path. And so I had teachers on the piano, on the clarinet, musicianship overall, and also as a conductor and composer, many different teachers that all contributed to who I am today by, as I said, extending themselves with their own generosity. And that's something that I think about a lot as a musician now and as an artist now, that that's that kind of work that you have to do in every way, that you always have to go above and beyond and become a person that offers whatever they have to the world as much as you can. That's the underlying maybe motivation as an artist for me. It's that sense of going above and beyond and doing more, giving more of yourself than is expected. That the expectations are just the baseline. So I was so fortunate to have those influences in my life that live that very model of behavior that I try and live today.
Well, 9 years old, I mean, that's extraordinary to be, just to say that you had an idea that's where you wanted to go that young. I've got kids myself and tried to teach one some guitar when he was about 10, and now he's 15 and finally starting to pick it up, at least have interest in it. Did it come naturally for you? And also, you mentioned a few different instruments. What different instruments do you play, and do you prefer any over the other?
I don't think that I really prefer any instruments. They're all different. I think that having a rich musical life is about finding the interest that you have in expressing yourself and living as an artist. And for me, that's led to a varied kind of musical life. I know many people that are highly fulfilled by playing just a single instrument and doing it with a kind of monastic and disciplined excellence, and that's their kind of musical worldview. But for me, it's always been about having different elements of musicianship, not only different instruments and different kind of disciplines within music, like composing, conducting, and performing, but also different genres. That's always been something that's very important to me, this recognition that I think a classical technique, which is not related to classical music, but a classical technique, you know, the system for learning, say, the violin or the trumpet or the piano, through the lens of classical music, gives you variety and gives you scope in terms of how you approach your musicianship. And what I mean by that is that a lot of people associate the technique of playing these instruments with a specific repertoire. Like, you learn to play the piano a certain way, that lets you play Mozart and Beethoven and Brahms. But from my perspective, learning the piano a certain way actually just opened the world up to use that technique to play lots of different styles of music that I love, and to try and do that with respect, and to try and do that with real understanding of where those styles come from, so that you're not just dabbling, but trying to really immerse yourself in it. But I had an early love of improvisation, which led me to want to play jazz, and then ultimately rock, and folk music, and bluegrass, and klezmer, and then even hip hop, and genres that you might not expect so-called classical musicians to espouse or to really love. So as I said, my musical interests are varied, both in how I perform, but also in the genres that I play.
Do you have any kind of specific process or creative process when you create a composition for a new project, or is it different every time, and do those inspirations kind of come from different places and every time?
The creative process, I think, has to reflect what you're trying to accomplish, so it really depends on the project, and it depends on the kind of musical work that you're trying to create. So the process for creating, say, a solo piano work or an electronica composition or a piece of musical theater will be different depending on the affect and the ultimate life that the piece of music is going to have. But almost all of my work begins at least with the same improvisatory technique. Like, I really believe that using improvisation to let yourself speak naturally through music is very important to me. It's what allows the sentences to flow from one part of the paragraph to the next, and the paragraph to connect together into a chapter in a natural way. I find that a lot of times abstracting that process and trying to just create music in kind of a vacuum or by selecting notes that seem right at a time but not connected to an actual kind of linguistic pronunciation of musical art does not yield a natural result overall. And every composer has a different method, and people can create very natural flowing music purely, say, at a computer. But for me, it almost always begins at a piano where I'm just purely improvising and trying to create music as if I was actually speaking. So that's my process from the beginning. But then, of course, it varies depending on what we're really trying to create.
Sure. And do you, so day of show, do you have any kind of superstitions or pre-concert routines? You wake up, you do ABC, and then an hour before the show, you're at a certain stage. Do you try to stick to the same routine on performance days?
Honestly, at this point, I've done so many weird performances and played in the most unusual settings. A lot of my life has been about taking music and removing it from its most traditional settings. And what that's done is changed my perspective of what a performance really is. And also the way you mentally prepare for it, because it used to be when I was only doing more traditional classical concerts in a concert hall, very formal, kind of, procession where you enter the stage and bow, and that was all I knew. It was much more, traumatic and, anxiety inducing, because that really is not a format that yields, I think, a comfort for the performers. I mean, unless you really have nerves of absolute steel, you're like one of those, rock climbers that they don't get an adrenaline rush when they're climbing up the face of a mountain without ropes and tools. But unless you're like that, I mean, it's really uncomfortable for everybody, no matter how talented you are, no matter how prepared you are, getting that kind of anxiety. But when I started performing in all these weird, as I said, settings and places, especially this thing I did back when I lived in Miami called Random Acts of Culture. It was a Knight Foundation program that they asked me to help design. So they had this idea that they would have musicians go and into places where no one expected music or dance or whatever kind of art form might be experienced at the time, and you would go and just surprise people with that art. And it wasn't meant to be like a flash mob. It wasn't aggressive at all. It was just to give people a little artistic experience and bring that into their lives in an unexpected way and see what that might do. Anyway, I was asked to do those kind of performances all around the country and to do as many as we possibly could on tours with a group that I had. And when you end up, trying to present these surprise concerts at a gas station or, bursting into a classroom at a university or things like this, hospitals and airports and you name it, we've probably played there, pumpkin patches and just on street corners outside of our van where we had a little sound system hooked up. It really loosens you up in terms of what it means to perform, and it takes you outside of this very formal experience of trying to play really well and much more into the realm of, hey, we're trying to engage people here. We're trying to really focus on the audience and to get them to be excited about what they're doing as opposed to just making it about your performance, which is, I think, a rather limited experience.
Well, we are all excited about the upcoming season, returning to live in-person performances and concerts. But after last year, you guys really shifted to the digital and video streaming experience for your patrons when many orchestras around the world and just kind of sat back for things to go. You guys really did the opposite and really had a season of new compositions and new programs for the educational series you guys do. And from what I understand, like 200 videos or something crazy like that. So you, instead of being passive about it, you guys really went pedal to the metal and really, use that to your advantage. What did you learn from last season, and what are some of your takeaways, and how will the experience you guys had producing last season kind of affect the way you're going to approach this season and how you put it together?
Well, last season was obviously an immense challenge, as it was for anybody in the events world, and I think we witnessed a pretty dramatic range of responses to what happened from our different various arts organizations around the world. And it's really quite fascinating because you couldn't have predicted how people would have responded based on their previous work. And you saw a lot of folks kind of run scared, people that had been quite daring in previous seasons actually being incredibly conservative during the pandemic year, and others that maybe you wouldn't have expected them to really do something quite exceptional, use this as an opportunity to change and to try things and to find success in a perhaps a new way, redefining what success might be. And for me, my number one goal, number one, number two goal, but number one was to keep the music coming out to the city, to continue to provide important bonding and meaningful, passionate experiences for people in a year when so much was kind of so much loss was felt by everybody. It was just a sense of loss here, loss there. Everywhere you looked, there was something that was either missing or something had been taken away. And so that number one goal of giving people something, so that rather than a loss, it felt like people were getting a gift. That was my number one goal for the community. And then number two, just as important, I guess you could say, was to keep the entire organization healthy and to make sure that every single person in Louisville Orchestra, staff, administration, and of course musicians, were all employed. That was very, very important to me because it's like a sports team or like any group of people that work together in a very intimate way, which is what an orchestra is, both on staff, but especially the musicians themselves. You can't just sit out a year and expect to be able to play at the same level in 12 months, 15 months, whatever it might be. It's not possible. You will lose so much of the mental, the kind of psychic connections that make an orchestra sound great. It's not something that can easily be just restored. It's not a matter of flipping a switch and saying, okay, well now we're an orchestra again. So for me, the idea of keeping everybody employed, keeping everybody working, keeping the music going, it was both external, which the city needed in a year of loss. In many ways, we had loss in so many different forms. You know, I think there's the loss from COVID, but there's also the loss of innocence and the loss of a sense of community cohesion and with the equity side and the health side, you know, that we were hit very, very hard. And so there was that external need to supply, as I said, a gift that I think music provides. But the internal need to keep the orchestra alive was so critically important, even if that wasn't something that people saw.
Well, we've certainly missed the live and in-person entertainment and performances across the genre, whether it's a concert or music festival or one of your fantastic performances. What do you think that first performance is going to be like in October when the lights go down and you're ready to play the first note?
Well, we've already been playing in-person concerts now. We just had our fourth one, actually, on July 4, out on the waterfront. And so we've already regained a sense of what it's like to play for a live audience, which, of course, is different when you're doing large-scale outside performances for you know, tens of thousands of people versus the experience at Whitney Hall. So we, you know, obviously are really excited to get back to the hall, but we've already had this kind of spiritual reawakening, you might say, of playing for people in person again, which is, I mean, look, the virtual space is extraordinary. I try and give credit to the opportunity to play music virtually, because it's very easy to just dismiss it and say, oh, it's not the same, it's not the same. Yeah, but it's an amazing, amazing gift. It's an incredible platform that's been given to us. And even when it feels like we're so tired of screens, we're so exhausted by digital communication, and rightly so. That's a very valid complaint, and I think there are a lot of negative elements to